the fifth case this morning, U.S. v. Conley.
Good morning. May it please the court, gentlemen. I'm Gary Ravitz, and I represent Kenneth Conley, who is appealing from the sentence of 20 years he received following his conviction for the offense of bank robbery. That sentence was in no small measure the result of allegations at sentencing that Mr. Conley obstructed based on an escape from the MCC Chicago. I'm prepared to say that the government's case at sentencing did establish by a preponderance of the evidence that allegation. The issue here, however, is whether the use of a preponderance standard is appropriate when the government relies on a pending criminal charge in aggravation of a sentence that is being imposed in a different case. We recognize that the Double Jeopardy Clause does not prevent the government from separately prosecuting Mr. Conley for the enhancing criminal conduct. However, I respectfully suggest the use of a preponderance standard to enhance waters down Mr. Conley's rights in the pending case.
Well, but he's not being convicted of any offense here. I mean, it is increasing his sentence, but...
That's right.
That's what the guidelines provide. I mean, it's a... We take into consideration matters that may not be able to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt in court.
And yes, but what's unique about Conley's case, Your Honor, is that you have a pending charge, and there is a panoply of rights that attaches to that pending charge. He was indicted by the government. He was arraigned. He pleaded not guilty. He's presumed to be innocent of that charge. And he could stand on that charge and force the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in that case, alleging escape, that he committed the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Those rights are somewhat watered down by relying on a preponderance standard to enhance his sentence for bank robbery on the basis of the obstructed, given that the obstruction is based on the same, the escape.
Mr. Ravitz, would you agree that... case law makes clear the preponderance standard can be used to consider uncharged conduct.
Yes. And that's Reuters says.
And so. Acquitted conduct?
Yes.
And convicted conduct?
Yes.
So why is it improper to consider charged and pending conduct?
The difference, Judge, is that his rights remain intact in this case, whereas in the case of acquitted conduct, he's had his day in court.
Won. Isn't that a much stronger case for excluding it?
Judge, as a defense lawyer, I would agree with you 100%, but that apparently is not the law. In the case of uncharged conduct, again, he has not invoked his rights under the Constitution.
He may never get those rights under the Constitution.
That's right.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is, given where the law is, it seems to me you're kind of custom tailoring a special rule here, the reasoning of which I really don't understand.
And that's exactly what I am suggesting. I'm suggesting when the government makes a decision to charge someone in a separate case, when it exercises its power to do that, then a special rule is appropriate in order to vindicate the rights they have triggered by leveling that charge.
Neither brief, if I recall correctly, Mr. Ravitz, talked about 18 U.S.C. 3661, the statute that says no limitation shall be placed on the information concerning the background, character, and conduct of a person convicted of an offense which a court of the United States may receive and consider for the purpose of imposing an appropriate sentence.
That's right. And I don't think that we have argued that the judge could not consider it. Well, we suggested in the briefs and in the district court was, first, the judge could exercise the discretion not to consider it. He could direct the government, you guys take this pending case, fight it out there, and Mr. Conley will live with the results of the government, will live with the results of the substantive case. We've said to the judge, that if you're going to consider this, you should not apply a preponderant standard. You should use a higher standard because of the constitutional rights that were triggered by the government's decision to charge Connolly in the first place. And we made a technical argument that the guidelines themselves set a limitation on the court's ability to consider pending charges to cases involving an assessment of criminal history. But I would agree that the statute is pretty clear that the judge ordinarily can consider these types of matters. It's just a question of what standard of proof is going to be used in their consideration. The problem I see is that despite Connolly's presumption of innocence and his invocation of constitutional rights in the substantive case, as a practical matter, it's problematic whether a defendant could ever defeat the lower preponderance standard and the relaxed set of rules that appertain in the sentencing hearing. As I say, we don't quarrel with the government's position they prove this case by a preponderance. We just think that that's not the appropriate standard here. There are other things to keep in mind. Assume a defendant actually has a defense to the substantive charge. He's being forced at an early stage either to take the hit, if you will, or to show his hand, giving the government what I think is an unfair advantage. And there are real-world consequences here, even though technically Connolly's being sentenced for bank robbery and not, as Your Honor points out, not for the pending charge of escape. I mean, there are real-world consequences here. I think we reasonably calculated in this case he was looking at maybe 14 years, maybe less, at sentencing. This allegation, I think, has added easily 6 or 7 years to the sentence in the bank robbery case. Here the government not only has brought additional charges, but will seek additional penalties. Now, Connolly's case is admittedly a little bit unusual. But I think that it's not unusual. It's unusual in part because the government ordinarily doesn't pursue these kinds of separate charges. I mean, Connolly's case has gained some notoriety, perhaps explains it. I'll rely on Mr. Ness to tell us why they brought the separate charge. But typically what you see in these cases is relevant conduct argued out in the sentencing hearing, followed by a dismissal of whatever remaining charges there are. And that seems to be a far more typical set of circumstances than you have in Connolly's case, where he's been separately charged and it's being used not only to enhance a penalty in case A, but arguably to result in a longer sentence after case B is prosecuted. So what we're going to ask the court to do is to carve out a limited exception. And this is a small class of cases. But in this kind of case, I think it's appropriate to hold the government to a higher standard than a preponderance. And I understand in Reuter the case, the court considered that. More recently in Hamilton, the court considered that and rejected it. But I do suggest that Pew has maybe called for a reevaluation of the effect that the guidelines continue to have, albeit they are advisory in nature. If the court doesn't have any further questions, I thank you for your time today.
Thank you, counsel. Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. There are two reasons that the judgment of the district court should be affirmed in this case. First, the district court committed no error in finding that the defendant, by escaping from jail, the MCC, before his sentencing, obstructed justice within the meaning of Guideline Section 3C1.1. As the commentary to that guideline makes clear, one example of the type of conduct to which the adjustment applies includes escaping or attempting to escape from custody before sentencing. Your Honors, that provision is not rendered inapplicable simply because the defendant has been charged in a separate case with escape, because it's settled law that the same conduct can support both a sentencing enhancement in one case, as here, and a criminal conviction in another. Second, Your Honors, contrary to Mr. Connolly's contention, the long-established rule that sentencing facts are to be determined under the preponderance standard correctly governed at this sentencing. This court has repeatedly and recently explained that a burden of proof beyond the preponderance standard is not needed for sentencing factors that do not serve to increase the maximum punishment. Here, the district court's finding that the defendant escaped from jail before his sentencing did not increase the statutory maximum sentence of 20 years. Moreover, Your Honors, nothing in the recent decisions of either Pew or Alleen has altered this rule. I'd like to talk briefly a little bit more about Section 3C1.1. As I mentioned, that application note or application note 4E to that guideline says that it can apply in situations like this where the defendant has pleaded guilty or been found guilty and is awaiting sentencing. I would just direct the court to United States versus Bright, which was a case we cited in our brief, a bank robbery case in which a defendant escaped from custody, I believe at the First District Chicago Police Headquarters, while being transferred from state custody to federal custody. This court took a look at Section 3C1.1 and at the application notes and found that an escape or attempted escape from established physical custody is covered by this guideline. So I think with respect to Mr. Connolly's argument that nothing in the guidelines sanctioned the application of the instruction enhancement here, I think that's clearly wrong. Turning to the burden of proof issue, Your Honors, the case law is very clear that uncharged conduct, acquitted conduct, can be considered for purposes of enhancing a defendant's sentence. And as Judge Hamilton was questioning on, I think that it's clear that there's no reason here, no logical reason, that it shouldn't apply as well here. This court has found as recently as...
What about the tactical point? I mean, that in essence, this gives you a... You can manage this on the prosecution side so as to get a... to force the defendant to... contest this without the protection of the rules of evidence, without lots of other protections, and well before he might be tried on the actual charge for escape.
Your Honor, I think there's a very straightforward answer to that I don't think Mr. Connolly would like, but it's that he put himself in this position. A defendant who chooses to escape from custody while awaiting sentencing.
Sure. Saying he's guilty is not really a very satisfactory answer, though, since that is the question that remains to be decided in the pending case. And you and I can both imagine circumstances, for example, in which there might be a coercion or duress defense that may or may not be applicable to Mr. Connolly's case. I don't know, but that's not really the point. Where using it as conduct as a sentencing enhancement in an earlier case gives the government the ability to force him to make that defense much earlier than he would.
Your Honor, I think there are two possible responses to that, I think at least. Number one, again, when we're talking about the point of sentencing for a convicted charge or charge for which somebody's been found guilty, we're sentencing the whole person, and we're looking at their conduct under Section 3553, the offense conduct, what they did before and after the finding of guilty. All of that goes into determining what an appropriate punishment is for that crime. So we're talking still about sentencing for the crime that's been convicted. So we're not punishing the person for the act of escape. We're punishing them for the bank robbery and in looking at all the factors under 3553. Now, with respect to the tactical issue, I guess that the defendant has the chance to defend under the preponderance standard as well.
Did he respond to the submission that there was an escape involved?
Yes, Your Honor. He responded in the sense that at sentencing we put up a witness, an FBI special agent, who testified as to the facts, and Mr. Connolly's lawyer, Mr. Ravitz, engaged in a lengthy cross-examination of the agent. And so there was a defense in the sense that Mr. Ravitz attempted to poke holes in the agent's testimony, but ultimately the district judge found that we had proven it by a preponderance. So Judge Hamilton, I think that when we're talking again about the issue of whether there's a tactical disadvantage for the defendant, again, it really boils down to, I think, the purposes of sentencing. And I would add as well that if we're talking about a prejudice, ultimately a prejudice to the defendant, it's really no different in the sense that if you're going to hold somebody, use conduct that's been acquitted or not charged in a sentencing, which this court has held as permissible, I don't see that there's any more prejudice to someone who's currently facing a pending charge. Now, there may be a tactical issue with that in terms of how the defendant goes about it, but I do think, again, that I don't know of any other way to get around that other than to say that defendants in that situation have put themselves in that situation. And I don't think that the prejudice inquiry changes that because it's no different than uncharged or acquitted conduct. Your Honors, returning again to the issue of the burden of proof, I think, as this Court has found repeatedly, there is no call for a higher burden of proof other than preponderance. It's been well settled. It's been...
Nothing wrong with asking for it, though.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Absolutely not. Your Honor, for these reasons, we do respectfully ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you very much. How much time?
Your Honor, unless you have additional questions based on the arguments you've heard today, I don't really have anything to add.
Not for purposes of this, but the next time, don't start to talk until you get to the microphone because they're trying to tape it, and you kind of blurs off as you go bombing.
My apologies.
It's okay with me.
Thank you.
You took this case by appointment, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Well, you have the thanks of the court for your fine representation of your client.
I appreciate that. I wish I had made the honor roll. Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. And